You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. We take all kind of pills to give us all kind of thrills, but the thrill we never know is the thrill that'll get you when you get your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone. If Dr. Hook can raise the funds, they can be on the cover as often as they like, as Rolling Stone magazine is put up for sale. My guests, Linda Yu and Sebastian Borger, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Germany's reassuringly tedious election, the UK's efforts to set in place trade deals nearly as good as the ones it already had, and Aung San Suu Kyi's continuing journey from hero to outcast. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Linda Yu, the economist and broadcaster, and Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung. Welcome both. And we start in Germany, which is entering the last week of campaigning before a federal election in which fans worldwide of solid, reliable, predictable government are hoping for an overdue change of luck. Polls suggest that, indeed, there is at least one country out there which has no particular urge to upend the established order just to see what will happen, which is to see that Chancellor Angela Merkel, who has already been in the job for 12 years, which seems even longer amid the present tumult, seems likely to win a fourth term. Sebastian, is there any chance of an upset?
No.
Okay, well, that's easy. We've got another 6 minutes on this, though. So
But seriously, I mean, we have an upset of the old order in the sense
really?
That we have, for the first time since 1969, really quite right-wing, you could almost call it neo-fascist party, has a good chance, or indeed is fairly certain, to be elected into the Bundestag.
This is Alternative for Deutschland.
Alternative for Deutschland. And if they, if the opinion polls turn out to be right, or indeed, as I suspect, slightly underestimate their strength, they may well be the third party in parliament. So in that sense, we have a problem on our hands. If you talk about government, yes, it'll be Angela Merkel. There's no doubt about it. Although, of course, it'll be quite difficult for her to find people and to join her in coalition, which otherwise she won't have her own majority. That's out of the question.
We'll come back to AfD and what a result for them might mean. But Linda, looking at the continuation of Merkel from the global perspective. Is this something that the wider world should be pleased or at least relieved by?
Yeah, probably the latter in many ways. She is, she's a leader that has been around for 12 years. People know where she stands. And increasingly in an era where President Trump of the United States has stepped back from leadership on issues like climate change, Angela Merkel has been seen increasingly as a global leader. So I think in that respect, not having a huge upset would be welcome. But I should probably say, I don't think we were ever expecting a huge upset. I think the alternative, Martin Schulz, the head of the SPD, he is an ex-European Parliament president. And so I think the leading contenders were always going to be more status quo in Germany than maybe we've seen in some other elections.
Sebastian, is she still able to govern effectively, her personally? Because regardless of whether you like a particular national leader or not, after a certain period in the job, they tend to run out of ideas, they run out of steam, run out of sanity in some cases. I mean, she's been doing this for 12 years. She's looking at extending that. Is she still on top of the job?
I think probably, if you compare her to other people who've been in the job for quite a long time, she's probably better than most, I would have thought. She does have that background of having been forced not to be in politics until she was 35, simply by living under communist dictatorship. She has the background of being a fairly accomplished scientist. And so, and she's married to a you know, quite renowned scientist in his field. I think she's quite, from her background and her upbringing, able to you know, stay true to her values and her personality, more so than we've seen with other people who get much more deformed by office, as far as I can tell.
Linda, you made reference there to the unpredictability, volatility, etc., of the present leadership of the United States. Will this anticipated result, i.e. the continuation of Merkel's rule, further establish her as the replacement leader of the free world? And how comfortable does she appear with that title?
She would appear to me to be a reluctant leader. I think she's a cautious leader, even though throughout the Eurozone crisis, it's very clear that Germany calls the shots. I think she's not herself a self-aggrandizing, self-promoting type of person. But I think for a lot of people, if she continues down this down the route she's been taking, especially, as I say, on climate change, you can also say she has an affinity with Emmanuel Macron. We could see more European reforms down the line. So all of these market opening measures, her stance on refugees, which has been an issue in the campaign, I think all of these things will mark her out as somebody who, as a major economy, is taking or is in a position to take a number of steps to put forward policies that I think, you know, quite a few centrists might welcome, excepting the euro point. I think the more euro point is more contentious. But I think on things like climate change, refugees, I think these are all issues that America has stepped back from. And I think she has, had to step in for.
Sebastian, you mentioned earlier that the possibility of a result for Alternative for Deutschland. Do you have any sense of how many MPs they might be able to get elected? And if they can establish a presence in Parliament, how much trouble can they actually cause?
We measure a success much more in the vote share, because, of course, the vote share translates exactly into share in the parliament. I'm afraid I haven't got the figure. I think it's 630 overall. We fear they may have 10%, which translates more or less into 60 members of parliament. I mean, the only good thing about that is that there'll be a lot of duff and indeed totally incompetent people in there. And they will, given their form over recent years, fall out within about 2.5 hours after the election result is called. But it's a measure, you know, in a rich country, in a stable, fairly solid country like Germany, for 10% of the populace, and not just in regions, in sort of neglected regions like the parts of former East Germany, but also in very solid southern regions like Baden-Württemberg, for 10% of the populace to actually give these people a vote, I think is quite troubling. And that means that both Merkel and the Social Democrats, both conservatives and the Social Democrats, have a problem on their hands, because they clearly don't connect with a large number of voters.
Okay, well, let's move on slightly now and look at the continuing frictionless progress of the well-oiled machine that is Brexit. The UK's Prime Minister, Theresa May, has decamped for Canada, partially to prepare the ground for a post-Brexit trade deal, partially because it's a long way from Boris Johnson, or would be were the Foreign Secretary not in New York speaking to US President Donald Trump at the UN, which means that the War of 1812 could resume at any moment. A new trade deal between Canada and the EU comes into effect this week. Theresa May, in an unimprovable summary of the Brexit process as a whole, hopes to negotiate a deal as good as the one that the UK therefore already has. Linda, first of all, will a deal with Canada, assuming such a thing can be struck, is that going to fix everything?
It's not going to fix everything, but
that's
actually, wouldn't it be nice if this was all over? But I think it actually forms a template, which we should really take rather as a good step the government is taking. And this is the reason why. if Canada, and they've been signaled they are, willing to cross out EU and write in UK on CETA, which is the Canadian-European Free Trade Agreement, then that model could actually mean that all of the current free trade agreements the UK is part of, as part of the EU, and that is actually something like 80 FTAs plus another 23 which are being negotiated or renegotiated. All of this is already embedded in British businesses and in British legislation. And so to step out of these FTAs and then renegotiate new ones is both time consuming, and to do that for about 100 agreements, it's going to take decades. So I think in many ways, if this works, you can have a free trade agreement the UK will already be a part of. Day after Brexit, you keep the free trade agreement with this copy and pasting, crossing out EU, putting in UK, and then revisit problematic provisions further down the line.
Can it literally be that simple with all of them, though? Because this does sound very close to what the Brexiteer fantasy of how this was all going to work, that everything will just be incredibly simple. All you have to do is go through these treaties, sort of scribble out EU and write in UK. It's not going to be that easy with all of them, is it?
No. And in fact, one of the big sticking points will be immigration. So, for instance, if the UK wanted to do that, you have to presume that the other country is willing, whether it's Canada or Japan or another country like that, is willing to give the UK exactly the same terms that they would give to the EU. But we already know, for instance, that there's a free trade agreement. Some of the free trade agreements that have been discussed, they would view the UK as less favorable than the EU as a whole. So, for instance, Japan has sort of signaled that. So they may want more in return. And now if you extend this to other trade deals that the EU hasn't really made that much progress on, but the UK is trying to negotiate. So, for instance, one with India. India wants freer immigration. And so
that'll be massively popular with
exactly.
The people who voted for Brexit.
So it's not straightforward. But think of it this way. Where you can, you make practical gains. So this is my favorite trade example, which is the UK is going to extend the EU privileged trade arrangement, preferential trade agreements with 48 developing countries. That ensures that these countries, these 48 countries, they are responsible for 72% of the tea consumed in Britain. And so it safeguards foodstuffs, agricultural products. Hey, I like my tea. And so, you know, this is not a bad way to start when, to be honest, you know, there's no way that the Department for International Trade could negotiate more than a few of these at a time. And certainly redoing 100 is just not feasible. You need to have a much more practical way forward.
Sebastian, we have also seen over the weekend Boris Johnson, the Foreign Secretary, unveiling his Brexit blueprint. I quite like the fact that one of his bullet points was that Brexit will be a success.
I've laughed.
I've started laughing.
I started this topic laughing. But of course, you know, come on. Theresa May off to pluck low-hanging fruit that every idiot could pluck in Canada. I mean,
It took the EU seven years to pluck it, in fairness.
Yeah, but they've done it. There it is, fresh on the table. So there's really no problem at all. You cannot seriously compare that to any serious FTA with Japan or countries like that. It's ridiculous, sorry. Johnson is. I mean, I just think if typical that the day on Saturday he should have been fired. Any self-respecting prime minister of a functioning government would have fired the man, clearly. The fact that he hasn't been fired, the fact that the poor spokeswoman for Theresa May actually has to say she has full confidence in him.
Which, in fairness, is usually what gets said about a minister just before they get fired.
We shall see. It tells you all you need to know about this bunch of no-hopers.
She has a difficulty there, though, doesn't she, Linda? Because if she does can Boris Johnson, she has to find a Brexiteer to take the job. Because when you know she was a closet Remainer, she has appointed Remainers to the two other great offices of state, Home Secretary and Chancellor of the Exchequer. She's got to come up with somebody. And unless she really wants to play it for laughs and send Jacob Rees-Mogg out onto the world stage, if only the listeners could see the horrified look you just shot me. She's kind of struggling for choices, really.
Yeah, I mean, there's also Andrea Leadsom, who I was going to say, of the prominent Brexiteers.
If only the listeners could see the horrified look I just shot you.
So of the Brexiteers, I mean, these are, these are the most prominent ones.
Michael
so, yes,
Gove?
I think...
What's wrong with Michael Gove?
We've only got another 15 minutes.
At least he has a brain. Sorry. No. Seriously, I mean, I think Michael Gove is at least... I know he stabbed Johnson in the back and suddenly wanted to become Prime Minister himself last summer, which was a completely stupid idea. But I think he would be a much better Foreign Secretary than either Boris Johnson or Andrea Leadsom. Because he's actually able to listen to people. I mean, the problem with Johnson in the post is he's a laughingstock. For you know, I keep telling people, people who are kind enough to read my papers, he's a very intelligent man, no doubt about it. He's got a great brain, but he's totally obsessed with his own career, and he has lost all credibility with anybody who counts for anything in Europe. So this question of is he a Brexiteer or not doesn't matter one jot if he's supposed to do a job. If all she wants him to be is in the cabinet so she can discipline him, where is the discipline? Mm-hmm. And then you send him to do health or agriculture, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that Michael Gove has actually distanced himself from Boris Johnson's article, and I think it's actually left Boris looking slightly more isolated. I think one of the big problems in this cabinet, just kind of broadening it out, is this divide between the Brexiteers and then those who are much more prone to remain. And I think see eye to eye is one of the reasons why the negotiations are diffuse.
It's the Tory civil war, which has been going on for 40 years.
Yeah, but
now it's all laid bare because they actually have to have a way forward for the Brexit.
But aren't there lots of internal, even within the Brexit camp, for example? I mean, Johnson and David Davis, from all I hear, can't stand each other and have very different opinions. And I mean, don't assume that all the Remainers are on the same page on all of these issues.
No, I think they are all on different pages in some respects when it comes to Brexit.
we will doubtless have further cause to discuss this, especially in the build-up to Theresa May's big speech in Florence later this week. We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Linda Yu and Sebastian Borger. Coming up next, is Myanmar about to become a pariah state all over again?
Monocle has bureau around the world in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
There's something about Tokyo. Once you're here and you live here, it gets more and more interesting. It's such a big city, but I think also it's just one of these very layered cities. Most months, actually most weeks, there's something new to keep us interested. You know, either it's a new development or a, you know, really interesting new building, a new fashion brand, something going on.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Linda Yu and Sebastian Borger. Now, it's difficult to think of an international figure whose reputation has fallen so far as Aung San Suu Kyi, the pro-democracy activist, heroic sufferer of house arrest, Nobel Peace Laureate, a secular saint of Nye Mandela-esque proportions, now damned by the Secretary-General of the UN as all but an accessory to ethnic cleansing. Antonio Guterres has said that Myanmar's de facto leader has a last chance to restrain Myanmarese military operations in Rakhine State, which have now prompted the flight of perhaps 400,000 Rohingya people into neighbouring Bangladesh. Linda, could she stop this if she wanted to?
I think that's the question, isn't it? She is the civilian leader of Myanmar in a kind of complicated, she can't actually be the head of state because she's got children born to foreigners. And, you know, it is an open question as to whether or not she has the authority to stop the military from this ethnic cleansing. But what is clear that she does have is that she has the moral authority to do something about it. And I think that's probably where all the criticism is coming from, the head of the UN, as well as others. asking her to do more. I don't think they necessarily think she can end the suffering of these Muslims, but I think they think her silence speaks volumes. And where she has spoken, it's being so moderate that I think that's really where her, as you say, you know, how far she's fallen in terms of stature. I think a lot of it is down to that.
Sebastian, are we learning something here about who's really in charge in Myanmar?
Obviously. I mean, talking about moral authority, she may have lots of moral authority with us here in the West. I don't know, to be frank, but it seems to me that her moral authority with the people carrying guns and obviously having power in that country isn't all that high. So the question, I suppose, is short of resignation, what can she do?
Well, Linda, there is one somewhat disquieting conclusion you could leap to here, and a few people have pointed out that there was a similar campaign against the Rohingyas 5 years ago, during which she said roughly nothing as well. Is it possible that she's not altogether unhappy at seeing the back of them?
I don't know enough about her personally to know her personal stances, but from everything that she has said in general, why she has the stature that she has is that she has, you know, certainly being herself a symbol of tolerance, of peace, of trying to effect change through nonviolent means. So I would be, I don't think she would share some of the prejudices that this predominantly Buddhist country has towards Muslims, which I think is one of the reasons why this particular issue is so volatile. Whenever religion comes into it, I think there is a real power behind it. I think one of the worrying things about her silence now and then is that there are signs of radicalization of these persecuted Muslims. And I think that's why the pressure is on now, years later, to find a peaceful solution to what could be and already is a really a dire situation.
Sebastian, she is conspicuous by her absence at the General Assembly of the United Nations this week, either because she thought she wouldn't get quite the reception she's used to, or perhaps she thought it mightn't be a smart time to leave the country. It could be one of those moments at which the locks could be changed in her absence. But is there a response the world can make, other than, as Antonio Guterres has done, hoping that she sort of rises to her previous billing as a great moral conscience?
Guterres, I think, played it right. He's basically saying, you act or else. We call it ethnic cleansing, and then there'll be presumably sanctions of some sort. I suspect, unfortunately, she, you know, Nobel Peace Prize winners get this glory and are assumed to be semi-saints. Some of them are, I guess. Mandela was, Václav Havel was. Lech Wałęsa of Solidarność in Poland clearly wasn't, you know, given the bigoted and partly racist statements that we heard from him. And maybe there is something in the suspicion that she is, in that sense, part of that rather racist culture in her own country. Who knows? But you know, we just have to reckon with the fact that our image of her may not be what she is.
Is there an argument, do you think, Linda, and I'm not sure what the mechanisms are, as Sebastian points out, the Nobel Peace Prize has been given to some somewhat rum customers over the years. One thinks also of Yasser Arafat, Henry Kissinger. If there isn't a formal mechanism for withdrawing one, and I'm not sure whether there is or not, would a statement by the Nobel Committee saying, if we'd known then what we know now, have any impact?
I think it'd be quite extraordinary if they made one, because that would sort of suggest that the choice was really quite wrong. But I think there's always this issue, isn't it, that, you know, a person over their lifetime You know, Obama has sorted this issue about being given it too early. I mean, I think, you know, I think there is a...
I think the smartest thing he could have done was refused gracefully to accept it.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, and I guess for her and Myanmar, you know, the opening up and the dismantling of the military government was a massive achievement. I was there right after it opened up. It was called the last frontier. It is literally the last major country to be opened up to the world and to be returned to a civilian rule. And I think...
North Korea?
It's a bit of a special case.
Yeah. But in terms of, it's the same. It has the same population as Britain, as you know, as France, as Germany. Yes. It's a major, major country. Yes, closed it off for so long, and she was instrumental nearly two decades in opening it up. So I can see why the Nobel Committee rewarded that. But once in power, politicians, I'm afraid, are rarely held in the same kind of esteem as. Others.
Indeed. So finally tonight, then, those of us who do work or have worked for the music press are painfully aware of what uphill work it is these days to get anybody to pay for a single issue. What price then an entire music magazine? We are about to find out as Jan Wenner puts up for sale Rolling Stone, the title he founded 50 years ago and has published ever since. This isn't quite as dramatic as the headline suggests, given that he's already sold 49% of it to BandLab, a Singaporean country, last year. But nevertheless, Sebastian, first of all, were you ever a big reader of Rolling Stone?
Putting me on the spot. That's very naughty. No, I've been reading all sorts of stuff. Not Rolling Stone, I'm afraid. No, I'm more of a classical music fan, I have to admit. But of course, you know, it's got a great image. And I love the way Jan Wenner says, I want someone with lots of money to buy. That's the problem in the media generally, isn't it? Whether music or whatever else.
Well, the question is, of course, what you're actually buying. When you look at this country, you know, like a once proud title like the NME, which is now given away at train stations, a once proud title like my former employer Melody Maker, which no longer even exists. Linda, would it make... I mean, the thing is, like, everyone knows the name Rolling Stone, but that's not the same as anybody actually going out and buying the thing or therefore buying advertising in it. How tempted is any media company perhaps going to be by the brand and the legacy? Are they going to be sort of more gulled by that than by the 21st century reality?
I think this is why finding a buyer may be hard. Of course, they are in a better position than some other magazines because they do have a brand that's associated with cutting-edge rock, with being cool, with, you know, if you are an aspiring singer, being on the cover of Rolling Stone would be an absolute, you know, coup. But that could all happen digitally. And I think that's become the challenge in the publishing industry. So the question is, how big of a online presence does Rolling Stone have? Does it have the same cachet to online audiences that would cause you know, advertisers to buy there? I would suspect that would have a lot of impact on the final, if it, you know, does get bought, on the final sales price. I don't think it's going to be the hard copies of Rolling Stone that's going to carry the value. And, you know, this is not specific to Rolling Stone. I think, you know, there have been a number of magazines and newspapers, including the ones you've mentioned, which have found that in this digital age, getting people to pay for paper copies is increasingly difficult.
With exceptions, of course, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, you know, here in Britain, The Economist magazine has still quite a lot, a big, and is now enlarging its print circulation, despite having a very good website. And the satirical magazine Private Eye, of course, has virtually no digital existence at all and is doing really well selling printed copies. So it's such a weird business, publishing, isn't it?
Final brief thought on this, though, Sebastian. Do we understand yet whether upcoming generations of potential readers are bothered one way or the other about the heritage of a title like Rolling Stone? Is that going to mean anything to a 20-year-old?
I'm not a marketing man, but I would assume if 18, I've got a 19-year-old, they can be very fanatical about learning about their field of interest and expertise. And if you are fascinated by that kind of music, you will come across Rolling Stone and that tremendous image it has. Why not? Yeah.
That does bring us to the end of today's show. Sebastian Borger and Linda Yu, thank you both very much for joining us. The show was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, researched by Katie Watkins. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. More music next at 1900. It's Culture with Robert Bound, and there'll be more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. I'll be your host for that. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening. We'll